This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll get an update from Butte County Superintendent of Schools, Mary Sakuma, to learn about the county's plans and what they're envisioning learning could look like when the school year starts. We'll also head to Sierra and Plumas counties to look at how some growers and nonprofits there are working to help meet the increased demand for food during the pandemic. If you have questions or comments for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216, or you can head to our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, July 14th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. Explosive growth in cases of the novel coronavirus helped lead to statewide restrictions as rapid community spread grips parts of the North State. Governor Gavin Newsom cited transmission rates and dwindling beds at local hospitals as part of the reason for shutting down drinking establishments and resuming certain restrictions statewide. The caseload across the 11-county North State now stands at 1,791, with two counties reporting more than 400 cases. Meanwhile, test positivity rates of 11.5 and 11.8 were reported in Colusa and Glenn counties, respectively. Officials have warned that anything above 5 is concerning. The statewide rate is currently 7.1. Public health officials in Sutter County were reporting 421 cases on Tuesday, Butte County 416, Yuba 211, Shasta 203, Glenn 183, Colusa 135, Tehama 121, Siskiyou 43, Lassen 36, Plumas 20, and Trinity County 2. The number of patients hospitalized across the region stands at 38, down 10 from Monday. Fatalities across the region stand at 18. Statewide, fatalities increased by 47 on Tuesday, the most recent figures available from the California Department of Public Health. A total of 639 Californians have died from COVID-19 over the 7 days ending Tuesday. Deaths are increasing at a weekly rate of 9.9%. That figure is up slightly from Monday and more sharply compared to a week ago. Public health authorities confirmed more than 7,300 cases, sending the total statewide caseload to 336,508 on Tuesday. That represents just more than a 21% jump compared to a week ago. At a press conference Tuesday, Dr. Mark Gawley, Secretary of the California Health and Human Services Agency, acknowledged some issues concerning delays with obtaining results from COVID testing, saying some labs have been overwhelmed by the volume, but that the state is working on fixes. Gawley was asked by a reporter if contact tracing was still viable with the rate the infection is spreading.
Contact tracing with this level of transmission is much, much more difficult.
Gawley said California has 10,000 contact tracers in the field and was working with individual counties to train additional tracers from a pool of state employees. In other news, drive-through testing will be available Wednesday in Susanville from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Lassen County Public Health Department. You can register online at projectbaseline.com. by clicking on COVID-19. For help, call 251-8100. Free testing will also be available in the Valley Wednesday in Los Molinos at the Veterans Memorial Building on Sherwood Boulevard between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. No appointment is necessary. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. The traditional start of the school year is just weeks away. While the Trump administration and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos are pushing hard for schools to resume, some parents, teachers, and others fear that with transmission rates exponentially higher than when in-person instruction ceased in the spring, catastrophe will be the end result. To help quantify the risks, understand the precautionary plans, and envision what learning will look like next month in Butte County, NSPR's Mark Albert reached out to Mary Sakuma, the county's superintendent of schools. Mark's first question was, what are the current plans for reopening?
Every school district or local education agency, like a charter school, each of them will develop their own specific plans for reopening and have them approved by their board of trustees or their school board. So what I can do is I can share with you what our BCOE programs and schools are looking at for options. But this, I can't answer on behalf of every school district because each and every one will have their own specific plans. What I can share with you is the, I have been leading an effort called the Butte School Sector Reopening Committee on behalf of the Butte County and Butte County Public Health. And that group has really been focused on the health and safety issues, as well as developing specific protocols and flowcharts for what staff and school leadership will do in the event of a case or a suspected case of COVID-19 on their campuses. So I just wanted to be clear that we're working on those kinds of plans, but again, the specific programming for every school district and charter school will be approved locally by their boards, not by BCOE.
What guidance have you received from the state? It seems like they should at least provide a template for all of these local officials rather than have people go their own way. And, you know, does BCOE even have the expertise to know whether one of these plans is more likely to be successful or not?
Let me address your first question. Yeah, we've received quite a bit of guidance, both from the California Department of Education, as well as from the California Department of Public Health, and of course, the CDC. The California Department of Education would be the experts in this area in regard to providing guidance and support out to various school districts. But it's really important to note that that is guidance. It is not directive. So there are many examples of other guidance out there as well that has been helpful and that has been developed by a variety of groups, including the Association of California School Administrators, CSESA, which is the County Superintendents Group, and a number of other groups that are have various areas of expertise inside education. But again, there's nothing that is a specific directive. I want to be clear about that.
And so then what expertise, or do you feel confident you have the expertise not necessary to evaluate and approve those plans or to find weaknesses in them and to suggest improvements?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, I think in every school district, the reason that local control is so important here is that not every plan would work in every school district, nor does every school district necessarily have the capacity to run a certain type of program.
Mary, how practical is the guidance you've received from the state, and what issues, if any, with those recommendations do you foresee as possibly making them less effective?
Well, as you can imagine, there are a number of challenges that present themselves with any of the guidance, not the least of which is the issue around figuring out how to keep these 6 feet minimum of social distancing when we're trying to meet the needs of all kids. So a number of our districts and charter schools and BCOE as well, we're examining what that can really look like. And so obviously that means that not all students can be together every day if we're to meet those strict guidelines. As you know, there has been at times conflicting guidance and advice that makes things really, really challenging. I am amazed at the creativity of our local educators and how hard they're working to try to figure this out. And I think that as far as efficacy goes, I don't think we're ready to judge that. But obviously, in the best of all possible worlds, we would have our kids back in school, you know, 5 days a week, 100% of the time. But we know that that's just not possible right now. So I think each district and charter school are really working hard to prepare their individual plans. And I suppose at the end of the day, we'll see what is or is not practical or effective.
Children, especially younger ones, tend to explore the touch and taste items in their environment, potentially raising the risk of transmission. older children, especially as you get into junior high and high school. There's a lot going on outside the classroom in terms of socializing, playing, horsing around, recess and whatnot. What will be done to reduce the risk of transmission?
Let's talk for just a moment about preschool age children. And I'm going to speak now specifically about the programs that BCOE runs for state preschool. So first of all, there will be a significant reduction in group sizes. So programs that normally would have had 20 students with two or three professional teachers in the classroom will now have 10 students with two teachers in the classroom. Again, this is for state preschool specifically. Our school leaders are working on ideas such as developing individual buckets of supplies. So that bucket of supplies would be assigned to a specific student and kept separate. They're obviously going to do a lot of cleaning and wiping of surfaces throughout the day. They're planning for lots of outside time. And for some items that might be available for use that would need to be reused, say, for another group, those items would be set aside and then cleaned on a daily basis so that the child to use that item the next time would have a clean and sanitary item, whether that's a toy or some kind of supply. And then finally, it's actually going to be a very interesting time, I think, because those 10 children in a cohort group will have the amazing benefit of having the attention of highly qualified staff working with them every day in a very small setting. Again, this is very specific to preschool programs, state preschool programs that we're running. Oh, and of course, every day there would be frequent cleaning and sanitizing and disinfecting. In regard to your question about older students and them wanting to be near each other and horse around maybe during free time. You know, I think it's going to really be dependent on teachers and staff really working with students in the first few days of school and talking with them about the importance of social distancing and really working on specific routines as to what would happen during passing time, what would happen during breaks during the day, what happens at lunchtime, et cetera. And again, those specific plans will be developed by individual districts, but I imagine that everybody is taking into consideration the fact that, you know, our kids have been out of school for a really long time and they want to see each other. They miss each other. They miss their teachers. They miss the staff. And so it's going to be a big challenge for sure.
Among the ideas being floated around are partial schedules, partial days, smaller class sizes. Will there be enough teachers to implement any of those?
Well, again, I hate to keep repeating this, but I think it's important to note that every district is looking at that individually. But yes, I believe that the districts are making plans to make that work, but it's definitely going to be a big challenge. Again, it will be dependent upon the different options that school districts offer to parents and families. As I'm sure you're aware, a number of districts have published some tentative plans that are under consideration. And we're awaiting this week and next the final plans that are approved by each of those districts and charter schools. But yes, I mean, districts will do what it takes because that's what we always do. But I would be remiss if I didn't also note that we are facing some very challenging economic times, and there just simply never seems to be adequate resources to do what we're asked to do, and this is no exception.
What would be the triggers if cases start appearing in schools? Is there a certain number of cases that would force a school to close or send an entire class home?
As I mentioned before, the Butte School Sector Reopening Committee has really been focused on these types of health and safety issues. And so we are developing a series of flowcharts that will be used by school staff in collaboration with Butte County Public Health. And for cases that are confirmed positive cases, there will be a very specific flow chart that both Butte County Public Health and our schools will follow. And each situation will be different. So for example, if we have a positive case confirmed in a classroom that is able to run as a single cohort, in other words, same group of kids every single day, no switching classrooms, it's the same teacher and other staff members present in the room, that would be treated a little differently than if you had a student who has potentially been a part of multiple classes throughout the day and has moved more freely around the campus. Public health will be there as our partners. They've been really great partners in the planning of these documents, as have our school nurses been lending their expertise to these flowcharts, and they will be followed by school staff.
School budgets in California are based on average daily attendance, or ADA. How will this impact the revenue and budgets of schools?
What has happened with the adopted state budget is there will be a hold harmless for school districts and charter schools, which essentially means their apportionment will be based on ADA through February of 2020, so the month right before the school campuses closed due to the pandemic. So for most of our schools, that is helpful. They can plan on those numbers and they know that they'll be receiving funding according to that plan. However, for those districts or charter schools that were in a growth mode, it really could pose a big problem in regard to their funding because none of that growth will be recognized in their funding for the school year 2020-21. The other big challenge that we're facing, and I can't emphasize enough what a big challenge this actually will be, and that is that beginning in February, there will be cash deferrals. So apportionments that would be intended for that particular month that would be sent to schools will be essentially deferred until several months later in many cases. So this is a big concern in regard to a school district's cash flow. There are certain times of year, in particular in the late spring, that school districts are not allowed to hold a negative balance in their funds with the county treasurer. So it is going to require that school districts look at obtaining loans to help them with the cash flow during those spring months. And so we're exploring some different options of doing some kind of pooled borrowing so that we would have an economy of scale as a group of school districts, including BCOE.
What options are going to be available for teachers who are not feeling comfortable or who are at a higher risk or perceive themselves as higher risk or have family members who are at a higher risk who might not want to do in-person teaching?
So there have been some new pieces of legislation that will allow for additional leave time when someone has a confirmed situation that causes them to be more at risk. And again, each district will be needing to work with their personnel on the specifics of applying those particular kinds of leaves of absence. As far as a long-term arrangement for working from home as a teacher, again, those decisions have to be made at the local level. We are examining that right now within our own organization and trying to be as creative as we possibly can be in order to meet the needs of our staff. Again, we're going to follow the guidelines and the laws that are provided for our staff. And, you know, I think, and this really brings me to an important point, we want to emphasize that we are concerned about the protection of our staff and our employees. And so, you know, to the greatest degree possible, we are going to make provisions for providing a healthy and safe work environment. And that includes the availability of hand sanitizer, hand washing stations, appropriate personal protective equipment or PPE for everyone. And beyond that, I think school districts and school organizations, including BCOE, we really are going to have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
And when you say leave, you're meaning, I'm imagining that's not paid leave, and that verified high risk, meaning they'd have to be able to provide proof from a physician or medical practitioner.
Yes, to your last question, we would require some verification, indeed. We also, of course, have to take into consideration what the guidelines will be in regard to populations that are at risk, for example, the over age 65 staff, for example. Your earlier question in regard to paid or not paid leave will depend on whether the circumstance falls under the new legislation that is, I don't have it right up in front of me, but there are some provisions for paid leave depending on the circumstance.
That was Butte County Superintendent of Schools, Mary Sukuma, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. More just ahead.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Wealth Management, where advisors work with their clients to develop flexible investment strategies that can evolve as their needs change. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. RWJF.org. Support for NPR comes from this station and from X-Chair, maker of the X2 home office chair with dynamic variable lumbar support and 10 ergonomic adjustments, donating to Gladstone Research Institute to fight COVID-19 at xchair.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. The COVID-19 pandemic has put extraordinary pressure on places we eat and buy food, and low-income residents in rural communities have been hit especially hard. Emergency providers like food banks and pantries are seeing their numbers skyrocket, and grocery stores are struggling to keep shelves stocked. As part of our rural reporting project with CAP Radio in Sacramento, reporter Nina Sparling takes a look at how some growers and nonprofits in Sierra and Plumas counties are trying to help meet the increased demand for food.
This is perfect.
Rugged Roots Farm sits just off Route 70 in Plumas County, a few minutes past downtown Quincy. The first thing you see when you drive up is an old, buzzing refrigerator.
We wanted it right up at the front, so when people park, it's like the first thing they see.
Leslie Pace runs the farm with Jesse Mazar. They pack the fridge full of produce most days of the week.
So we have some butterhead and red lettuce here. We're out of our carrots, but we have two different kinds of carrots.
Leslie and Jesse call it the Honor System fridge. People record what they've taken and how much it cost in a notebook. And the fridge has been a rare, reliable source of fresh produce during the pandemic.
And then our mixed greens are really popular. Usually we fill both shelves with that. And that's
Rugged Roots Farm is a program of the La Sierra Food Project, a nonprofit that Leslie and Jesse started in 2019. At first, the pandemic looked like it would make for a difficult season farming. But pretty quickly, that changed.
We definitely are growing more food than we were planning, though, because of COVID. Yeah. We were going to grow 1 acre, and then we doubled that.
Jesse and Leslie expected they might sell about $50 worth of produce a week out of the fridge. So far, it's been bringing in hundreds of dollars a week. And the fridge is one of a handful of ways that Leslie and Jesse have been working to get their food to the people who need it most.
That'd be perfect.
They also do a weekly produce box at a range of prices. Sean and Gabriella moved to the area in February to work at an outdoor education nonprofit. The roommates found themselves unemployed within weeks.
It definitely provides like a sense of security as we're trying to navigate unemployment.
Leslie and Jesse ask people to volunteer 9 hours over the whole season to receive 15 weeks of free produce. As with the fridge, many more people have signed up than they expected. In part, that's evidence of how COVID-19 has changed how people in Plumas and Sierra counties are getting their food. Tammy Muldoon runs the High Sierra Family Resource Center in the Sierra County town of Loyalton. In a typical week, 60 or 70 families would come to pick up free food.
But after COVID, now we had about 140 families that we were seeing in like April, May, June.
That increase is partly due to financial pressure, but Tammy says it's mostly because people aren't headed out of town to stock up on groceries like they did pre-pandemic. There is one grocery store in Loyalton, but
it's small and it's a small town and the prices are high and they might not have what you want. And they certainly don't have bargain food.
Megan Mansfield has seen the same trend on a county level. She's a health educator at the Plumas County Public Health Agency. More people started to shop locally rather than cross state or county lines to buy food. That put a lot of pressure on supply chains.
Our grocery stores were empty, especially fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains, as well as meat and dairy. We were out for quite a while.
Throughout Sierra and Plumas counties, people have been turning towards food banks and food pantries more and more. And Megan says the pandemic has put a magnifying glass on an issue that's already been very present.
We are not food sovereign here. We do not have enough food to last all of the people in this county even a week if a bigger disaster hit and we couldn't import our food here. That's really scary. That's really scary.
That's the same issue that Jesse and Leslie are trying to address with the La Sierra Food Project by growing food for Plumas County in Plumas County.
Our goal was to make local food something that people in our community can access. There's a lot of lower income community members here. Doing this project, a big part of it was making sure that most of our community can have access to the produce that we're growing.
Responding to this kind of need is part of what Jesse and Leslie hope the farm can do, crisis or not. Nina Sparling, Cap Radio News.
And that is your program. As always, if you have any thoughts for us, you can leave them on our message line 433-9216 or on our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Rodeville, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wookie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.